Hello, and welcome to this episode of Bite Back Chats Books, where we chat to Dave Rich. Dave is one of the UK's leading experts on anti-Semitism. He has worked for almost 30 years with the Jewish charity, the Community Security Trust, and advises the police, the Crown Prosecution Service, football clubs, political parties, and many others about how to tackle anti-Semitism, whilst writing and appearing on a range of leading media channels. His new book, Everyday Hate, is about how anti-Semitism is built into our world and how you can change it. Blending personal anecdotes, contemporary examples, and historical insights, Dave takes the reader on a journey through this contentious and often confusing subject whilst revealing surprising truths about how anti-Semitism continues to thrive. Today, we want to chat about some of the subtle anti-Semitic narratives, the role of education, and what can be done to resolve this everyday hate on Jews. Hello, Dave, and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books with me, Nell Whitaker, and Ryan Norman.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And we're delighted to talk about your book, Everyday Hate. And I think we should just start with the title of the book, owing to the casual, unconscious, everyday, anyday characteristic in racism against Jews. And give some great examples at the beginning of the book. 60% of British Jews will sometimes take steps to ensure that they can't be identified as Jewish in public, such as removing a religious skullcap, hiding a Star of David necklace, or removing a school blazer on the bus. So, Dave, you yourself identify as a Jew and must have experienced this your whole life. So why now did you decide to write the book?
So, look, anti-Semitism, even the word itself can be quite a barrier to understanding what we're talking about. And it sometimes seems like this huge and awful subject, and it leads people straight to the Holocaust, and it's a terrible social evil that we all abhor and all the rest of it. And yet the reality is, for a lot of Jewish people, it is just every day. You know, it goes on all the time. It's kind of in the background, either whether you take the long view and look at history or you just look at data stuff in Britain or around the world. For a lot of Jewish people, it's just sort of there in the background. And I wanted to kind of get across that it is at the same time something completely awful and outrageous that everybody should feel an urgent drive to understand and try and tackle and deal with. But it's also a subject not to be scared of. You shouldn't be frightened to get into the subject because it is, in a way, quite banal. And I wrote the book now, look, for most authors, I imagine there's a whole range of reasons why you write a particular book at a particular time, but I thought there was a need, to be honest. Anti-Semitism has definitely both increased in itself in recent years, all the data shows it, but also become more of a topic, more of a hot issue. It's in the news a lot more, it's in politics a lot more, it's in theatre and the arts and TV a lot more, and yet I give talks about anti-Semitism around the country all the time. And the one thing I always take away is hardly anybody really knows much about it. And there's a huge piece of work to be done to just explain what this big, awful thing is. And my way of explaining it is to write a book.
Yeah, absolutely. And a huge sort of thing that the book is trying to achieve, obviously, is educating and just sort of letting people know where these tropes that are so deeply embedded within society have come from. And a key part of it, I guess, is that it's not just a handful of extremists. It's everyone, really, because these tropes are so common that you know, that there's a good chance that everyone at some point in their life has engaged with them at some level. And we saw recently that the theme of this year's Holocaust Memorial Day is ordinary people. And I had a look at that and read some sort of, you know, interpretations of that theme. Some of them were incredibly moving. There was a quote from somebody that said it's what's abnormal about them as a Jew and a Holocaust survivor is the fact that they are normal. You know, they've gone on to live a normal life. You know, they've had friends, they've had tea, they've had coffee, they've fallen in love. And that normality is abnormal. It's clearly something that can mean a lot to different people, this idea of ordinary people as a theme of Holocaust Memorial. And I wondered what it meant to you.
I think it's a really important theme, and it's a theme that opens up a lot of questions, I think, and some of them quite difficult questions, because I think when we talk about ordinary people in the context of the Holocaust, the first thing I think a lot of people go to is the responsibility on ordinary people to stand up to evil, to speak out, to there's the very well-known saying, the only thing that is needed for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. Well, here, good people need to do something. And there are so many examples from the Holocaust of really brave but ordinary people who didn't just look the other way and didn't go along with it, but actually help people, often at great risk to themselves. And we quite rightly celebrate those people. You know, we celebrate and cherish the Holocaust survivors and also the helpers who saved them. But when I hear the phrase ordinary people in the context of the Holocaust, the other thing I think of, and this is something I get into in some depth in the book, is that the perpetrators of the Holocaust, on the whole, were also ordinary people. And that's a much more difficult message to absorb and to think about. But in some ways, if we're going to create our own internal resistance to anti-Semitism, in a way, that's just as important a message for us to absorb. We love to think of the Nazis as psychopaths and monsters and all the rest of it. But actually, on the whole, most of the people who took part in the killing, who went along with it, who facilitated it, or certainly who just looked the other way, we're just normal people. And anti-Semitism, it's a product of our world. It's a product of our society. It's been around for centuries, and it's here in the here and now. And we're all vulnerable to it. And I try and make the point in the book, nobody should feel ashamed if at some point in their lives they've indulged in anti-Semitic stereotypes. They've heard something from a friend or seen it online or read it somewhere and they believe it and then haven't really processed what they're going along with. That's just normal. That's ordinary people. And we're all, you know, susceptible in lots of different ways to stereotypes and so on. But we all have it within ourselves to take the better path, in a way, to recognize this, learn about it, and recognize the moment when you should have something inside you saying, no, stop. And that's the message I try and get.
Yeah, absolutely. That's also so important. And I think that's why this book is so essential, because as I said earlier, what it does is it shows you, you know, in the cold light of day, what these tropes are, where they came from, and where they are in society. And I actually had a moment just recently, for the benefit of the listener, I was lucky enough to edit the book. Over Christmas, I watched A Christmas Carol, as my family and I do most years. We normally go for the Patrick Stewart version, but we picked the Muppets this year, which was very jolly.
I always go for the Muppets version, I should say.
Yeah. The songs are wonderful. But as I was watching and seeing these characters that I was so familiar with, I sort of did a double take and looked at Scrooge and thought, hold on a moment, here's a man, here's a cold, bitter moneylender who despises Christmas, this Christian tradition, has to go on this whole, you know, process of self-discovery and renewal. And only when he, you know, casts aside his bitterness and his moneylending and embraces Christ and Christian traditions, does he finally become this, you know, happy, fulfilled person who's loved by everyone. And that's just anti-Semitism, like blatant anti-Semitism. But you don't notice it, because I've never noticed it, because Scrooge isn't a Jewish character. He's just a normal, you know, Victorian man. And I realized that everybody that watches this book, this play, this film, reads this book, whatever form you consume it in, you take in the narrative and the tropes without really having to feel guilty about it. There's no barrier that, like, if Scrooge were to be a Jew, you know, people I think would question it a lot more, certainly these days, I hope. But because he's not, because he's just presented as this normal person, you internalize the idea that in order to find happiness, he has to embrace Christianity, that, you know, there are these cold, evil moneylenders out there. And when we find them, we should dislike them. It was really eye-opening as to how sort of every day that the hatred truly is. But I think, yeah, what the book does is show you that, and it helps you, as you say, kind of develop that internal resistance to it.
It's a really interesting example, actually, because of course Dickens did have an anti-Semitic character in Fagin, in Oliver Twist, which is a very famous anti-Semitic character, again, of a kind of unscrupulous criminal who preys on children for money and so on and so on. And Scrooge, like you say, is not explicitly a Jewish character. But what it's an interesting example of is how the kind of themes of anti-Semitism and get wrapped up with ideas of what is good and virtuous and what is considered bad and sinful and the opposite of how a good person and good society should be. And over many centuries, ideas from anti-Semitism, from the kind of demonization of Jews, kind of got transplanted into just broader cultural notions of what is good. And so things that were considered the opposite of what is good and virtuous and so on kind of get Jewified in the culture, but not necessarily explicitly so. And it's just the ideas and even the visual images, you know, of the visual, you know, if we think of a you know, wealthy, unscrupulous bankers and so on. Quite often they're depicted in cartoons in very similar ways to the ways Jews have been historically, but not by people meaning the bankers to be Jewish. It's just they've taken that iconography, that imagery from the history of anti-Semitism. And what I try and show in the book, I mean, it's not a history book, but it's a book about the here and now. But there's a lot of history in it, because you have to show where these ideas come from and how they've developed over a long period of time.
I think that's a really valid point. I mean, I learned a lot from reading your book about the history of Jews in Britain, which I was never taught about at school. I mean, I was only really taught about the Jewish religion in our RE and then the Holocaust and history. And I had no idea that 3,000 Jews were expelled from Britain in 1290. And I suppose, as you say, there needs to be some kind of education reform, or just it needs to be a bit more obvious from that point. And I just wondered how we can modernize the education system in Britain so it's more directed to understanding this everyday hate of Jews.
Well, education is absolutely key to this. I think we have to be optimistic. We have to think that we can learn and teach and grow our way out of problems like anti-Semitism. And I think you're right. A lot of this history, a lot of the stories are not taught. And when, you know, Britain's whole self-identity now is about a very modern, diverse nation, diverse population, and there's huge benefits from that. But the stories we tell about the Jewish aspect of that British diversity only go back so far. And I think if we went back into the kind of period you're talking about, medieval period and so on, and these things still have their traces and their imprint in modern days. You know, I was talking to someone just this morning who lives in Southeast London, was talking about how there's a road called Jews Walk just near where he lives. And, you know, these things last. And I think there are ways to teach it, to bring it to life and that make people understand how anti-Semitism fits in with broader anti-racism and the way to build just a more harmonious kind of society. One of the difficulties we have, I think, is there are simply so few Jewish people in this country. talking about 300,000 people, about 15 million Jewish people worldwide. And the Jewish community is very concentrated geographically. So there's huge parts of the country where a lot of people just won't know many Jewish people. A lot of kids don't go to school with Jewish kids, won't have Jewish friends growing up. So we need to overcome that. And I think education is a really important point, but not just formal education. I think connecting people is a really important way to do that. And I think that responsibility lies on both sides. You know, there's lots of different learnings and lots of different suggestions of what we can do. And one of them is very much, I think, to the Jewish community itself, to my community, to do what we can do to reach out and make those human connections, especially amongst younger generations.
And do you think making those connections will help with the slightly disconnected element of the language sometimes used between ethnic groups? I mean, in recent news, there's been discussion on hurtful language of these minority ethnic groups. And I know that your grandfather was labelled an alien. I mean, what are your greatest frustrations with the language used against Jews?
I mean, there's a whole lexicon of anti-Semitic insults, and some of them better known than others. Just in the news, you know, in the week we're talking, there's been all sorts of stuff about the use of the Y word in football, which is an ongoing thing. You know, you mentioned I write about the way Jews historically were treated as aliens going back to the early 20th century, and in my, you know, in previous generations of my family, how that played out and affected their lives as well. And I do think there's you know, I think there's nothing wrong with asking people to just be careful of using inflammatory and offensive language. It can go too far the other way, and sometimes there can be such an overfocus on using the correct language and not really missing and not really focusing too enough on the meaning, and kind of punishing people for just getting it a bit wrong innocently. And what is considered correct language does change through the generations, and sometimes we're a bit hard on people who don't manage to keep up with that. But language can also reflect attitudes, and it can influence attitudes. And I think using respectful language, language that understands and reflects shared humanity, even when discussing really, really difficult issues in modern society, can just help to connect people, I think, and just remove those barriers between different communities.
Yeah, definitely. It does feel like... you know, our generation coming through is
more aware.
That's the phrase I'm looking for. We're aware of it, and we're trying to be as conscious as we possibly can be about these, you know, correct terms, deploying them respectfully and stuff. I worry that social media makes it better and makes it worse, really. You know, on the worst end of that spectrum, it allows people to, you know, deploy truly hateful language and rhetoric without kind of having to face the interpersonal consequences of it. But then, you know, on the other end, you have people who, you know, who want to do the right thing and want to, you know, encourage the use of correct language, but I don't know, perhaps struggle to have a good kind of conversation with someone about it because there's so much arguing going on there. But yeah, I'm hopeful at least that that the younger generation is thinking about that as best as we can. Moving on towards the end of the book, you start to think about a way forward, how we can kind of start to really tackle this problem. Looking to edit the book, when I wrote the copy, the blurb for this book, one of the phrases I included was it alluded to eradicating anti-Semitism for good. And Dave came back and said, you know, while that would be lovely, we have to be real here. We have to be honest. That's not going to happen. This isn't something that we can completely eradicate. This is something that we can raise awareness of, and that we can encourage people to challenge, develop internal resistances to, and improve upon, but it can't be fully eradicated. So I was wondering, David, if you could talk us through some of the things that you think we can do in order to move us forward.
Sure. So I said I'm an optimist, and I am an optimist. But I think thinking that we can get rid of something that has been around for so long is maybe a bit over-optimistic. But that doesn't give us a get out to do nothing. You know, there's a very old Jewish saying that I use in the book. It's not your duty to complete the task, but nor are you free to desist from it. And I think that's a message for every generation, actually. That there's always an obligation to try and improve the world, to try and address these problems in our own time. And let's see where we get to. So I do make a few different suggestions. A lot of them revolve around education, which we've discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And education, I mean, it does connect to social media, and you mentioned social media. So many of the problems that we see with growing and spreading anti-Semitism today are energized and channeled by the way that social media kind of categorizes and distills and spreads information and ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I have absolutely no doubt that anti-Semitism just would not exist in the way it does and would not affect people in the way it does and reach the audiences it does without social media being the engine and the networks through which it happens. And social media companies are still doing nowhere near enough.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a whole area of work to be done there. But I think also more broadly, and I've always felt this about dealing with anti-Semitism, we can talk about laws and formal processes as much as we want, but so much of it is about culture and social attitudes. And there's a really important, I do think, obligation on all of us who consider ourselves to be anti-racist and opposed to discrimination and so on, to make sure anti-Semitism is included in that, to make sure that all our education, all our equality work, all our diversity work recognizes anti-Semitism, includes it in that work, includes it as what it is, mm-hmm. not just sort of bolting it onto racism, because it works in every different type of bigotry and prejudice works in its own ways. There's lots of overlaps, there's lots of continuities, but they all have their own unique identity and methods of work. So anti-Semitism needs to be recognized for what it is as well. So I think there's a whole area there for all of us working in this world to see what more can we do. And I am optimistic. You know, I do think anti-Semitism kind of waxes and wanes. It you know, there's a way of looking at it of thinking, well, every generation we get more and more progressive and open-minded and anti-racist and so on. And I think, and there's an opposite way, which is like anti-Semitism, you know, got worse and worse and worse until the Holocaust in this sort of linear path.
Yeah.
It comes and goes depending on what's going on in the world, depending on what's going on in society. We're in a particularly troubled, difficult time in the world at the moment. And that's when anti-Semitism tends to surge historically. Yeah. And I think we're seeing elements of that at the moment. So let's do what we can now in the here and now. That's on us.
Mm. And then we thought from your concluding points, Ryan's your question.
Sure. Yeah. If you, Dave, could give 3 copies of your book away to affect actual change for Jews and British Jews, who would you pick? It can be anyone.
Okay, so this is a really difficult one because there's a lot of people could be on that list. And I would say one of the things about anti-Semitism is that it's global. I mean, my book is focused on Britain, but it's not only about Britain. And I take in lots of things from around the world. So when we talk about how to improve things for British Jews, really, actually, we're talking about how to improve things in the round, around the whole world, really. So I think one of the copies will go to I was torn between Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk. Maybe they can share a copy, actually. But ideally, to be shared amongst the heads of all the social media platforms, because that's where it's at. That's where anti-Semitism is now. And their decisions can make a massive, massive impact, for better or for worse, on the state of anti-Semitism in the world. So that's one. Another one would be education is absolutely key, as we've discussed. So I'd like there to be a copy permanently residing on the desk of whoever is Secretary of State for Education, whichever minister, whichever party, because I'd like to think that the people responsible for education in this country would have that knowledge and want that knowledge and want to see what they can do to help. And the third copy, look, like I said, we're a small community, British Jews, and we need champions and allies well beyond the Jewish community. We need other people who have powerful and respected voices who people listen to and who can affect change and who will, you know, who can be our allies in this. And so the third copy will go to Marcus Rashford.
Ah,
there you go. Everyone loves Marcus, right?
Everyone loves Marcus. Yeah.
That's a really, I mean, it's a very tricky question. Great answers.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, it's been fantastic chatting to you about a book, and we're all really excited for its release, which is on the 16th of February. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Really looking forward to the book coming out. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bite Back podcast. Everyday Hate, How Anti-Semitism is Built into Our World and How You Can Change It, is available to pre-order now. Head to the Bite Back website to use the exclusive 20% off code HATE20. And whilst you're there, dive into some of our online Q&As with authors, or perhaps get involved in the Bite Back Six Nations. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with your questions or queries at BiteBackPub.